Welcome on behalf of Writers Centre Norwich and the North Carolina Norwich Festival to Dragon Hall, this fantastic building that was built in 1427 by Robert Topps to house the goods that he was trading with the Low Countries, now transformed 600 years later into an international house of ideas, words, for trading in those most powerful thoughts of all. Today is day two of our literary festival in the weekend, looking at some of the big ideas, the stories and the connections people make with and in the world around them. Yesterday, for those of you who are here, we took a look at the world that we live in today and where we've come from. A long journalistic look covering things like global movement, global migration, healthcare, mental health, all sorts of questions around inequalities and equalities in the world. Today we're looking at how we build a world afresh, how we what improvements we can make to the world we currently live in to ensure that it's as equitable, fair and prosperous for everyone. Later today, we have events with Timothy Garton-Ash exploring freedom of speech and how we have global conversations in a connected world. We have conversations with Steve Silberman, winner of the Samuel Johnson Prize, on neurodiversity and autism and how we can learn to trust and listen to our own respective skills and strengths. And we end looking at the Middle East of the future with young people growing up in the aftermath of the revolutions. That's all to come. Throughout the day, down to your right, front from right, we have Daniel Saunders live drawing the day, trying to capture some of what's going on, some of the conversations that are happening, so that it doesn't just happen today, that we have things to remember by and keep us going in the search to improve things. That's all to come, as I say. Right now, please join me in welcoming to the stage Charles Clarke and Lord Mervyn King.
Well, thank you very much, Sam, for that introduction. And, for me, it's a really tremendous privilege to be invited to chair this conversation with Mervyn. My name's Charles Clarke. I used to be the Member of Parliament for Norwich South, which includes the place where we now are. It's a great privilege for me to come back to Norwich from time to time, and I very much enjoy events of this kind. It's perhaps, as Sam implied in that, a particularly appropriate venue because this was, in its time, this building was the centre of some of the core economic relationships for this country, the trading relationships between England and the rest of the world, mainly Europe. And Mervyn's book, as we'll come to discuss in a moment, is addressing the economic ideas as to how our world needs to evolve, particularly in the field of money and banking, in the trading world in which we now live. The book that Mervyn has just written is called The End of Alchemy, Money, Banking and the Future of the Global Economy. Mervyn King, Lord King of Lothbury, has had a very interesting past, and I'm just going to ask him a couple of things about his personal history to kick us off. Your father was a railway porter and I think then became a geography teacher, and you were brought up in Wolverhampton. You weren't one of those metropolitan types, but you came very much from out away from London. You went to Wolverhampton Grammar School, went on to King's College Cambridge, which I've read, and you'll tell me whether it's true. You wrote in your book that you chose because of John Maynard Keynes' relationship to the college. But could you just talk a little bit about what your upbringing was, why you thought you'd try and do economics, why not physics, why not maths? What was it that brought you through your life to think economics would be a subject of interest to you for the rest of your life?
Well, let me first say how pleased I am to be in Norwich, because this is the first time I've had an invitation to come to Norwich, and that clearly was motive enough to write the book. My father was a school teacher, and he was trained as a teacher after the Second World War. There was a program for demobbed soldiers to train people as teachers, and that meant he moved around the country. So I went to primary school primarily in Yorkshire on the moors above Hebden Bridge, and went back there last week actually to open a new room in the school, and then Wolverhampton when I grew up. And I had to choose the subjects I was going to specialise in at an absurdly young age. That was the tradition in the grammar schools at that time. So I chose at a young age to specialise in maths and science. And as I progressed, interested in politics and particularly history, I wondered how I could apply that to those areas. And although my first dream was to be a cosmologist, you know, I used to was fascinated by the origins of the universe and what had to have existed before it started, and I couldn't quite work out what could have existed beforehand. But I wanted to be a cosmologist, but I was advised that to do that, you had to do science at Cambridge for 3 years first, and that meant doing experiments. Now, I was absolutely hopeless at doing experiments. I mean, I did well in the theory, but when you have to tie a thread around a glass stopper to measure it both in water and then in air, I realised that this was not my forte. The stopper kept falling off the thread. And I think in 4 years of chemistry, where you had to sort of heat chemicals and mix them with things to discover what they were, I failed to identify a compound correctly once, despite coming top in the theory in chemistry. So I thought, this is no good. I can't be a practical scientist. And it seemed to me, and I think this was borne out by the subsequent experience, that economics is something that you can do in a very theoretical way without any knowledge of the practical world at all.
Well, that does relate to the next question I was going to ask you. I was very frightened of you because, like you, I went to King's College, Cambridge, and I did mathematics in my first year, but then changed to economics, thinking it would take me to a more practical sphere of life. And you were the very brilliant economist a couple of years ahead of me, who set a model of what I could never achieve in terms of my grasp of economics, which you can perhaps tell in various aspects of my personal history. But you then, after you'd graduated, and you spent a significant chunk of your life as a professional academic economist, and before you went to the Bank of England aged 43 in 1991, and then you had a career in the Bank of England culminating in the governorship of the bank. But it raised the question, which I thought I'd just go to before asking about your book specifically, is the practicality of economics and how it works. You tell the story in your book of the desert island on which there's a physicist, a chemist and an economist, and they have a can of food and they have to consider how they open this can of food to be able to survive on the desert island. And you describe in your book the economist saying, we start by assuming we have a can opener. That's the way to deal with it. And many people would share that implicit criticism about economics, and you joke about it in the book very entertainingly. But could you just talk a bit about this practical or non-practical aspect of economic theory? Because it's what you come to in the book in really quite a lot of important detail. But could you perhaps just discuss that? You did your own intro by describing that experiments weren't your thing and you preferred the theory. But that's a very important question for economics in our modern society. If you could just talk through that a bit, that would be interesting.
Well, it is a very big question, and I think there's no doubt that really from around the time when we started as students in Cambridge, that the economics profession decided that it wanted to be like physicists. It wanted to be a proper science. Mm. And certainly there's no reason why economists shouldn't aspire to use a scientific method to evaluate data, to ensure that arguments are cogent and logically sound. But there's one very interesting comparison which shows precisely why economics is not a science. And this is where economics, I think, has probably gone wrong in the last 40 years. Contrast meteorologists forecasting the weather with economists forecasting the economy. Now, both groups have seen an enormous expansion of the power of computers. You know, the computer of our mobile phones is some considerable multiple of the power of the single computer that was there for the whole of the University of Cambridge when I was doing research in Cambridge after my first degree. So we have lots more computer power and a lot more data. And as a result, meteorologists are indeed able to make better weather forecasts. I mean, weather forecasts, they're not perfect, but they're demonstrably more accurate than they were 40 years ago. Is the same true of economic forecasts? No. Why? Because meteorologists are actually learning and discovering as they get more and more data covering a narrow area, the grid they look at when making their forecast for weather, they're actually studying unchanging laws of nature, physical laws of nature. And all they have to do is discover a bit more what those laws are. And they may look rather unpredictable because of the non-linear nature of the whole thing. You get big jerks in weather patterns, but there are fixed laws of nature. In economics, the thing that drives the big movements of the economy are big swings in beliefs or expectations. Humans are involved. And those changes in expectations or beliefs are not ones that can be modelled by fixed laws of nature. And I think economists, by trying to apply mathematics and statistics to economics, which are very valuable in many situations, got carried away by the idea that everything in economics could be explained in terms of a mathematical model.
But is it not possible that the way that people interact, society interacts, the way that humans interact, the way that humans behave, is something which is susceptible to greater understanding and their patterns of behaviour? We look at other animals and they have patterns of behaviour. It's just that we haven't understood it yet for economics or for more wider sociological patterns, rather than it's not understandable, it's simply that we haven't understood it, if you take my distinction.
Well, there are patterns of behaviour that you can see, and people talk about herd behaviour, and there is a field called behavioural economics, which has identified a number of so-called anomalies about how people behave differently than the theoretical model of economists. But I think deep down, it's not sensible to assume that people are irrational. I think people are rational. The problem is we are in a world of intrinsic uncertainty, enormous uncertainty, the kind of uncertainty that Donald Rumsfeld christened the unknown unknowns. And I think it's better to call it the unknowable unknowns, uncertainty that you cannot even imagine what could happen in the future. You certainly can't attach probabilities to it. And in that world, when you don't know what the future can possibly bring, it's better just to admit it and then say, well, what does it mean to be rational in a world of that degree of uncertainty? I call it radical uncertainty in the book. And I think that is something which is very hard. In that world, people don't optimise and behave like a maximising individual in the way economists assume. They cope. All of us faced with an unknowable world find ways of coping. And there isn't no unique way of defining that. People's behaviour will change, they learn something, they change their beliefs about the future, and so their behaviour changes. Now, we can certainly explore that and study it, and I have no objection to doing that in a scientific way, but I think the idea that behaviour is, you know, people behave as if they were calculating, using a big computer to calculate the optimal thing to do, is a serious mistake in a world in which people know there's no point doing that. But can they think of a strategist for coping with this unknown world?
Did you believe this when you were an academic economist before you went to the bank, or is it your experience since going to the bank and then ultimately becoming governor of the bank and then living through the crisis of 2007 to 2009? I'll ask you a couple of points about that in just a second. Has your belief that you've just articulated just now evolved over your life, or have you always had that critique of academic economics at the core of your beliefs before you became governor of the Bank of England?
No, it changed, and it changed in large part with the crisis. Mm. When I was a young economist in academic life, I too fell prey to this attraction of using computer models. I remember vividly reading the textbooks on macroeconomics that were available to us in Keynes's general theory and thinking, but you know, half of this seems very compelling, but the other half is completely incomprehensible. Mm. And the general theory itself, often described in all the Sunday papers as one of the great books of the 20th century, mm. we should all read Keynes's general theory, is actually in large parts incomprehensible. Mm. And that's one of the reasons why people don't want to admit that, and so call it a great book.
Let's hope that doesn't happen to your book.
So the attraction of going down the route of mathematical models mm. and using computers was that the arguments used were comprehensible and they could be tested rigorously. The trouble is that they omitted the key things that were driving people's behaviour and creating booms and slumps. And it's very interesting that the macroeconomics that came out of that presumption that you could build computer models and use mathematics, they were quite helpful in explaining how people choose to spend higher incomes on different kinds of goods and services, but they were hopeless at explaining booms and slumps, because that is the one field where big changes in sentiment and expectations really matter. So during the crisis, I went back, I reread the general theory, looked back at what people were writing in the 1930s, and realised that actually the bits that were most compelling were the idea of radical uncertainty, which meant that the market economy was not inherently self-stabilising. A market economy is not self-stabilising.
Let's now talk about your book specifically. What led you, what drove you to write the book? What were you trying to convey in writing the book? What was your excitement, your drive, your intellectual thought which you wanted to set out in writing the book?
Well, in the early days of the crisis, we were all preoccupied with just trying to manage the day-to-day issues that came up. But it seemed to me that, you know, within a year or so of that happening, and particularly after the collapse of Lehman Brothers and the need to support Royal Bank of Scotland and HBOS, that the ideas, the economic ideas that were traditional in economics and which were the ones that were embedded in all the models that the young people in the bank were turning the handle of to produce forecasts for us to look at, were seriously flawed. Mm. And seriously flawed in different ways. One was in having a decent model of how the economy as a whole was likely to behave, how expectations changed, really how you can get significant disequilibria building up in an economy which can suddenly abruptly change. And that really had not been given enough emphasis and weight. And then when it came to think about banking, I realised that not enough thought had been given to the challenges that would arise when trying to provide support to a modern bank as opposed to a 19th century bank when they came to the central bank and asked for support. And the ideas had not been fully thought through and in many cases were misleading. So I decided to write a book about ideas, but the moment that I was determined, that I decided I would write it as opposed to thinking about it, was when I was in Beijing meeting my opposite number. And
you start the book with this?
I start the book with this, really. This is really what prompted me to write it. We played tennis because that's the big sport for the hierarchy in China. And they have unbelievable facilities. You know, I had my own dressing room with two enormous rooms, separate bathroom and drawing room.
This is an egalitarian society.
Absolutely. and we had dinner, a proper feast in the state guest house in Beijing. So I got a lot carried away by these surroundings. I started by reminding him that of Premier Chou Enlai's alleged riposte to the question, what do you think of the French Revolution? To which he's alleged to have said, too soon to tell. Although Henry Kissinger denies that was said. But I said to my opposite number, I said, I want to know what you make of the Industrial Revolution. Because China was the wealthiest and most important country in the world for a long period, well before you fell into relative decline, and the Industrial Revolution, which started in my country, was very important. It spread to the continent and then to the United States. What do you in China make of it? And he said something very interesting. He said, well, we've studied this a great deal in China because we ourselves want to know why we fell behind the West. And we think that the benefits of a market economy and competition in driving productivity growth and higher living standards are something we want to emulate. And then he paused and he just turned to me with a bit of a gleam in his eye and said, but Mervyn, I'm not sure if you in the West have quite got the hang of money and banking yet. And what he meant by that was that after, 250 years of very successful productivity growth and rising living standards, even the relatively modest growth rates of 2.5% a year will increase living standards tenfold in a century. And that is a revolutionary outcome. And so they were very impressed by that. But right through that period, despite the rise in living standards, we'd had regular collapses of the monetary system in high inflations, hyperinflations, and banking crises right through the whole period. And indeed, I think you can argue that we know that the second worst hyperinflation in history had occurred in the 21st century. That was in Zimbabwe. But most of the big hyperinflations were after the Second World War, and 2008 was the biggest banking crisis ever. So far from these crises gradually diminishing in importance, they were becoming bigger and bigger. And this was the big drawback to the way we were running our economy. We hadn't got the hang of it. So I wanted to write a book which would explain, A, why we didn't have the hang of it, and B, what we could do to get the hang of it.
Very clear. Why did you call the book, given the history you've just described, The End of Alchemy, a subtitle, Money, Banking, and the Future of the Global Economy? What was the importance of this word, alchemy, which you wanted to put at the centre of your book and to use as the title to illustrate what you tried to convey as the answers to the questions you were just asking yourself?
Because our system of money and banking is based on a completely artificial set of values. They're not unreasonable at times, but they can collapse. So we accept pieces of paper as money. When I would go to schools, I'd take out a £10 note and hold it up, and I'd say, "What's this?" And they'd say, "Money." And I'd say, "No, it's a piece of paper, look." And I'd make as if to tear it, and they'd say, "No, no." And I'd say, "Well, why is it? What do you mean it's money?" They said, "Well, you can buy stuff with it." And then we'd talk about why you can buy stuff with it. Well, it depends on trust. The only reason you can buy stuff with these pieces of paper is because other people trust it. What they mean deep down, they don't trust the piece of paper. They trust the institution that issues the piece of paper. And, of course, very often in society, whether it was Weimar Germany or Zimbabwe or post-Second World War Hungary, trust disappears and those pieces of paper become worthless. So the question is, you know, what is it that gives value? Why do we trust something that has no intrinsic value? And the same is true of banking, that when we have deposits in a bank, we all believe we can go along and take the money out when we want. The only problem is if we all go along and take the money out at the same time, it isn't there. It's been lent out. So banking, too, rests on a degree of alchemy in the sense that if everyone tries to exercise their right to take the deposits out, you can't do it. And that has led a lot of people to worry about how we can reform our system in such a way as to get rid of these elements of alchemy. And that's, in essence, what the book is about.
You address that question by what would be a very radical solution for banks in our time, by suggesting that you have what I think you call narrow banks, but rather like our high street banks, which should be required to have resources to cover 100% of the claims on those banks which might arise, so that at any point anybody could be certain, even if everybody went, they could collect money. And then on the other hand, you'd have what I think you called wide banks, investment banks, which wouldn't have that requirement, but by the same token, wouldn't be bailed out if any issue arose. The state would be in the position, if necessary, to bail out the narrow banks, though because they had 100% of the money there, that probably would not be necessary. But the wider banks, the investment banks, would not be bailed out. And so central banks wouldn't, in that sense, be lenders of last resort as they've operated for the last 150 years, lending against collateral, but work in this new system. And that would require an absolutely dramatic change in the way that our banks currently operate. Now, I don't know if I've understood correctly what you're putting forward to deal with this. And perhaps, firstly, you could correct me if I've got it wrong. But secondly, perhaps you could articulate a bit, A, what is the solution, you think, to this alchemy problem? And B, how practical is it? How feasible is it? Could it happen?
So this distinction between narrow banks and wide banks is one that a number of people have advocated as the solution to the problem of alchemy. But as I describe in the book, it actually raises another big question and problem, and my own proposals try to deal with that. So the problem with the split between narrow and wide banks is if all the narrow banks have to hold very safe government assets so that the deposits are never at risk, that's fine for the deposits, but then how on earth do you finance mortgages, lending to small businesses or big businesses for that matter? And if you've only got wide banks who will do that, how can they obtain the finance? They can't do it by construction in terms of deposits. They have to raise equity finance. But this is a view that many economists over the last 100 years have pushed and advocated, and it's never happened. I mean, most of the most famous American economists wanted to get to this position. It's never happened. Why is that? It's because it maybe isn't the best way of doing it, because what it stops banks doing is actually using some short-term borrowing to finance longer-term lending. So what I do is propose something really quite new, which is to say that the central bank has to recognise that it's a pawnbroker. And perhaps I can just, for a minute, explain why that matters and why I saw this in the crisis most carefully. The tradition of a central bank being a lender of last resort, that if all the depositors wanted to take money out of the bank, then the bank would go to the central bank and say, look, we've got a slight embarrassment, all these depositors want their money back, could you lend us the money? And then when the panics subside, we'll pay you back. And Walter Bagehot in the 19th century came up with this proposal, and well, Henry Thornton did, really, earlier in the 19th century. Then Walter Bagehot became famous writing about it, and it was called the lender of last resort. And in Walter Bagehot's day, it was simple, because when a bank was embarrassed because people wanted to take money out, they literally would walk round the corner in the front door of the Bank of England and say, look, 30% of our assets are in the form of very safe government securities, short-term paper. So if you just cast your eye over this, can you lend us the money so I can walk back in 5 minutes' time and pay it out to the depositors? And it took the Bank of England no more than 5 minutes to check, yeah, this is very safe short-term government paper and we can lend against it. And so they went back and paid out the depositors. Come 2007, this is in 2008, when Royal Bank of Scotland needed to be bailed out, and they, over a couple of weeks, they would say, well, we used to be able to borrow money for 3 months, and now we can only borrow for 1 month, and then next week we can only borrow for 1 week, and then only for 1 day. And then they came in one day and said, look, we can't, we'll have to close the bank at the end of the day. This seemed a rather drastic thing to do. It would have brought down the whole British banking system. So I did something which is a useful trick to keep up your sleeve when talking to Premiership footballers. I wrote a cheque for 36.
You were chairman of Aston Villa Football Club.
Not chairman,
I mean, board director. Yes. Shortly before it was relegated.
I wrote a cheque for £36 billion. I don't know why you were raising the subject of relegation.
I was thinking of Ed Balls, actually.
And then I said to my staff, I said, so this loan we're making for £36 billion, what's the security we've got against that loan? And they said, well, it's on mortgages. And I said, well, whose mortgages? And we had no idea. And so what happens in a crisis in the modern world is the banks come in and they bring in collateral, which is not straightforward to lend against. And you certainly don't want to lend the face value of it. You need to lend a fraction of it. In other words, you impose a haircut on the amount that you'll lend against that collateral. And once you get into that position, it's quite clear that what you're doing as a central bank is providing insurance to a bank that if all the depositors turn up at the same time, you'll be able to lend to it, so that ultimately when the loans fall due, they're better repay the central bank. But you don't give people the benefits of an insurance policy without asking them to pay a premium beforehand. And we had failed to impose a premium beforehand. So what my scheme does is to say that banks can borrow short, issue deposits, they can then lend long-term illiquid loans if they want to. But what they have to do is to bring enough collateral to the central bank beforehand, in peacetime, before the crisis has occurred. Have the central bank examine it very carefully when the times are peaceful. Instead of doing it in 5 minutes, do it, take a month over it. And say, okay, if at any point in the next 5 to 10 years you face a crisis and need cash, we guarantee a cash credit line to you of, say, 80% against this collateral, or maybe 40%. Against this other collateral if it's riskier. And the bank has to bring enough assets to the central bank so that at the end of all this bringing the assets to the bank, the guaranteed cash credit line is big enough to cover all the short-term deposits that could run from the bank at a moment's notice. And if you were to do that, then you would actually be able to tell everyone, including the depositors, but all the other people who fund the bank, there is no risk anymore of a bank run. We'll never get one because everyone knows that there is no point, that the central bank has guaranteed a cash credit line to this bank.
Yes.
Don't leave it, in other words, until the crisis occurs. That's why I call the central bank a pawnbroker for all seasons.
I'm going to, in a second, after another couple of points, come to you, the audience, and ask for questions to Mervyn about what he's been saying. And I think he's articulated very clearly where he's going in his book and why it's a book of economic ideas. He has a whole series of other commentaries, for example, about an interesting chapter about the relationship between currency and nation, with comments about the euro within that context, and his speculation that if there isn't a substantial reform of money and banking, then further crises are inevitable along the lines that have been stated. But just before coming to you, I just wanted to say, Mervyn, you do say it's a book about economic ideas. It's not an account of the particular crisis of 2007-2009, which might be seen as self-serving. I think for the self-serving account, probably you can read Ed Ball's book, Speaking Out, Lessons of My Life in Politics, which is being published in September, and I'm sure you'll get that there in a very coherent way. But in the period, which must have been very, very difficult for you, were there any lighter moments, any particular things you recall looking back with enjoyment as you lived through those moments of crisis?
Well, there weren't many lighter moments. there was a lot of black humour amongst the team around me. I think one of the things I will never forget about that period was having an extraordinary, talented group of younger people, about a dozen people, economists, secretarial staff and others, who formed a very tightly knit group of people who provided wonderful support, such that I knew that whenever I went home at night, whatever would happen, they would handle it in the way that I wished them to. That made a big difference. But I suppose there was one moment I will never forget, which was 2009. It was after a few months after the peak of the crisis, and the UK had the presidency of the G20, and we were hosting the G20 meeting in London in the spring of 2009. And although the UK had the presidency of it, Angela Merkel decided that she wanted to get in on the act and wanted to have a pre-meeting for the European members of the G20 in Berlin on a Sunday in February 2009. This was Prime Minister Gordon Brown, Chancellor Alistair Darling, and myself as governor. Each country sent these three people, together with one, I think in the case of the Prime Minister, two or three aides. So a small group from each country. And round the table for the meeting, no more than 16, 17. So we were told to go to Northolt Airport, the military airport in London, to get our plane on a Sunday morning. So I turned up to be greeted by a very apologetic Treasury official who said, as you know, Mr. King, we were meant to take the Queen's flight from here to Berlin. Unfortunately, it's no longer available. I said, what do you mean, no longer available? This is sort of a summit with the Prime Minister. And he said, well, I don't know, but somehow the word golf seemed to appear in the description of what happened. Anyway, don't worry, Mr. King, do not worry. We have got another aeroplane. And in due course, half an hour later, it flew in from Edinburgh with Gordon Brown. It was to pick up Alistair and myself in London and then go out to Berlin. So I noticed it was a small plane. Well, I mean, there weren't that many of us. We didn't need a big one, but it was very small. And as it taxied along to the building where we were standing, along the fuselage, I could see the words Tyrolean Airways. Some Treasury official had gone on the internet and hired the cheapest plane he could get on a Saturday afternoon. Anyway, Tyrolean Airways turned up. We boarded the plane, and it came with a very pleasant, charming and attractive air hostess dressed in Tyrolean national costume. So we flew out to Berlin, and the idea was that all the planes would arrive at the same time. For some reason, Spain got invited too. I don't know why, because they weren't part of the G20, but that's the way of these international meetings. Anyway, when we landed, we taxied up to where there were already two enormous jumbo jets. One had the French tricolour on the tailplane, and the other the Spanish flag. And Sarkozy and the Spanish Prime Minister were standing there chatting, and they had their teams. Then we taxied up, and as the air hostess let down the steps for us, these rickety steps for us to sort of climb down, gingerly down to the tarmac, and We all stood, the British delegation, and turned and waved goodbye to this air hostess at the top of the steps. And I will never forget the look on Sarkozy's face. He said, he could just see what he was saying to himself. I knew the British were eccentric, but surely not this eccentric.
Well, I'm glad in the difficult times there were some lighter moments. Okay, over to you. If you'd like to put your hands up, I'll choose, and I'll probably take them in groups of three, if that's all right with you, Mervyn, to do it. And if I can ask you, as you ask your question, if you can just identify yourself and if you're from any particular organisation. I'll start right at the back, and then I've got two more on the central aisle here. So firstly, right at the back. Could you stand up and shout it out, please?
Yes, sir. So David Campbell Bannerman, MEP, and the European Parliament. Lord King, I just wanted to ask you, you did make a comment about the inevitable referendum, as you have heard, about the economic cost of leaving being highly exaggerated. Could you explain more about that? Because that was a very interesting intervention, especially the Treasury and the IMF, for producing these reports. Thank you.
Gentleman with the white jacket, that's right.
Yes, Duncan McInnes. I recently read Alistair Darling's piece on his period at number 11, covering the crisis. I don't know whether that was self-serving or not. But on this question of your valuing the assets that came in, I mean, it was perfectly clear that certainly the banks didn't know the value of a lot of the rubbish that they were holding. So how would we ever be able what the true value is, and do you have a view on the role of the credit agencies and their attitude towards these products and the grades and the credit that they're offering?
Thank you, good question. And the gentleman just here, that's right.
So Matthew Bowen, I'm a third year PhD student in the School of Environmental Science at the University of East Anglia. And first of all, I'd like to thank you, Charles, for chairing this debate. And you almost perfectly described the economic Victorian model developed and taken on board by China. And that's where my actual deep concern lies, because as well as Solly Zuckerman's, one of the founders of the School of Environmental Sciences. Now, scale. UK industrialised in about, let's say, 150 years. China, let's say, 30 years. Populations explode and resource demand grows. Now, traditional economic theory is still based on growth. Severely lacks consideration for the environment. Now, do you agree with this traditional view that technology is going to save future generations in the long term?
Thank you. Three very different questions, Mervyn. Take them in whatever order you fancy.
You may have to remind me what they were. I'm not going to comment on the issue of which way to vote on the Brexit referendum, because I remember when I became governor, my predecessor was very careful not to say anything either in public or for that matter in private that would make life more difficult for me, and anything I say will undoubtedly get back and be put in the form of a question to my successor. All I would say is that it's most important, and I've been very struck, back in civilian life as it were, that people come up and talk to me. Nobody has asked me how should I vote. A lot of people have said to me, I want to make up my own mind and I would like to have access to the arguments and facts to do that, as opposed to assertions. What is the case is, I think, on both sides, a lot of the argument has degenerated into a series of assertions. And on the economic front, I regret to say that many of these are implausible and exaggerated, because we can't possibly know. And I think a more humble view would be a better way of doing it. I mean, to claim, you know, one side would say that if we left the EU, we'd become a land of milk and honey, and the other side would say a land of locusts and plagues. Neither view is frankly plausible, and I would much rather people engage in this debate by saying, yes, you know, there are good arguments on both sides, but in my view, and then set out where they think the balance of arguments comes. I think people would listen to that and be more inclined to be persuaded by those arguments. I think we're not seeing it at present.
Can I just add a point before you go on to the other questions? I'm a very strong Remainer, but I very strongly agree with Mervyn's, your argument here. People can reasonably ask the question, What do you, as an individual or as an institution, predict would be the outcome of a Brexit decision? But it's very difficult. People are looking long-term into the future. And so the argument has become, by a number of the politicians on both sides of the discussion, very exaggerated. So I just want to say that despite the fact I am in a position to say and do say that I hope people will vote to stay in, I also very, very much agree with what you say, that much of the argument has become very difficult to, for people to look at credibly in what's happened. And this is, of course, very difficult for people because people want to know what will be the impact of the decision on June the 23rd. And there isn't a clear answer. There isn't a kind of silver bullet which says definitely it'll be in such a position or not. And so you've got a whole series of views coming through. But I'm sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to say, despite being partisan in the case, that I think your approach to this, of having a more nuanced discussion, is the right way to go. Sorry, there were two other questions.
Yeah, so one is about how would you value a wide range of complex assets. So I think under my scheme, the point is this. The central bank is making one promise, and it's a rather narrow one. It would say, if there is a crisis down the road, and you want liquidity against these assets, then we guarantee that this is the amount we will provide against this particular set of assets. Now, if these assets are very complex, difficult to understand, the answer might well be, we won't offer any liquidity against those assets. This is the choice of the haircut. That haircut would be 100%. If it was mortgages, you might not know, you know, everything about all the people whose mortgages it were, but you might, since British people do repay their mortgages, you might well be prepared to say 80 or 85%. But if it was an instrument that was very hard to understand, and I talk about one of the sort of rules of thumb that a central bank could use, it could say, okay, you've got 3 sessions of 15 minutes each to explain to us what this stuff is, and if we don't understand it at the end of that time, you're not getting any money at all. And they would have to finance those assets by equity finance. If they could persuade shareholders to buy shares in the bank to fund these risky assets, that's fine. That's no reason why the government should intervene on that. But the role of the central bank is to make that judgment as to what, because it's taxpayers' money at stake there. And the third question is this very big question about the environment and growth. Now, clearly the speed at which China has both industrialised and urbanised is causing them very many problems. The interesting thing is China's big enough that whatever pollution they generate tends not to drift across to Norway or over the channel to somewhere else. It does to Hong Kong, obviously, but it's felt within China itself. And this is something that they themselves are very concerned about. But I don't see that we should abandon the view and the idea that economic growth at positive rates is feasible and desirable. Most people actually demonstrate from their behaviour that they would like to be better off over time, provided that doesn't destroy our environment. And that is why in the future, technology, science, innovation will be the determining factor. Now, I can't know or prove that it will enable us to have positive growth rates which are not deleterious to the environment. That's something that we have control over through our domestic parliament, and we must work politically to ensure that we protect the environment in the way that we want. But I am very struck that over the past 50 years, the impact of a growing economy has been one that has not produced more and more emissions or more and more outputs of heavy steel and other industrialised commodities, that actually the economy is becoming one that's, you know, either weightless in the sense that you buy and sell services over the internet, or it's services which are provided by one individual to another individual. The growth of caring services will surely be a big part of our economy over the next 25, 50 years. These things do not in themselves necessarily damage the environment. And so I just think we have to see what science and technology will throw up. And I don't see any reason why we should be pessimistic about that. Most of the people I know in this area feel it's a golden age of scientific progress. But it is up to people like you and others to ensure that when the economy is allowed to produce more goods and services, that it's subject to collective restrictions that ensure that we don't damage our environment in an undesirable way.
Thank you. One small part of Duncan McKinsey's question was about credit agencies. Did you have Do you think that? Do you think they're wonderful institutions or dangerous peddlers of untruths? What do you?
I think the difficult thing is to know how you improve the system. I mean, I think what I did say is that I don't think that governments and central banks should rely on credit agencies. I mean, far too many people use this as the perfect back covering instrument. That, well, these people have rated at AAA, so we ourselves don't have to take responsibility for it. That's harder to do for people like pension funds and so on. One of the things that people pointed out was that the credit agencies were paid by the companies that issued the instruments that were then rated. The question is what you do about that. It's very hard to know because ideally you'd like the investors to pay the rating agencies to rate instruments that are issued. But that means us, pension funds and others. And I think we have to tackle that. I don't think it makes any sense to have a government body doing it. This was mooted in Europe. And what immediately became obvious was that the motivation behind it was on the part of a number of European governments, the belief that if only a government agency were to rate securities, all government bonds would be rated AAA. And that's no use to anyone. So somehow you've got to find a way of doing this in which the investors themselves agree to club together to finance it. And that is a big collective action problem because no one investor has any incentive to pay for it. They want a free ride off the others. We haven't really solved that problem.
Great. I'll now take another set of three. I've got a gentleman here, somebody there. I'll take those three. So I'll take four in this round. So firstly, the gentleman there. Can you just identify yourself, please?
Hello, my name's Bob Beveridge. I confess to being a journalist, but I'm here as an individual with some friends of mine to hear what you've got to say, Lord King. My question is, I can remember you a few years ago saying you were surprised that the British public hadn't become more angry with bankers. To what extent do you think the culture in banking has changed? I'm thinking, for example, that 10 days ago, the former managing director of Deutsche Bank in London was jailed for insider trading, a man making millions jailed for insider trading. He was also, by the way, advising the government on a board, advising the government about its holdings in the banks that we bailed out, RBS, Lloyds, HBOS. Very few, of course, that wasn't for anything that happened during the banking crisis in terms of the banks connected to the crisis, but that, to us as members of the public, betrays something wrong with banking. So to what extent does the culture need to change?
Thank you, very clear. There are a couple at the back there, that's right, you.
Hello, Steph Ackburn, local citizen, interested party. City, Treasury or Bank of England, if you were to start again afresh, perhaps reincarnated as a reformist from the get-go, which of those institutions would you plant yourself inside to implement your ideas in the book?
There's another, somebody else, yes, that's right, you. Thank you. And there was somebody in the central aisle here. Yes, you.
Given that you've both said about the Brexit question, is using a referendum the wrong way to get proceedings for in an issue such as the economics of the country and the area as a whole? And if not, what would you suggest?
Thank you. Okay, four, again, wide-ranging questions, Mervyn.
So let me just say that last one while it's in my mind, and then we'll try and circle back. One word will prompt me, I'm sure. Well, I think Charles is probably a better place to judge whether a referendum is the right way to make big decisions of this kind. I think there's a lot of interest in the referendum. I mean, it was very interesting in Scotland. It had a very high turnout of 85%. We don't know what the turnout will be in this referendum yet. But people have been, clearly interested in the fact that they've been given a vote. And I'm struck when I meet people that they want to exercise that vote. As Charles said earlier, what's unfortunate is that we're not getting enough people standing up and saying, this is my vision of the role of the United Kingdom in Europe. whether it should be in the EU or outside it. That would be the positive case for their position. What we seem to be getting is everyone giving negative arguments, which is not a very enthusing set of issues and arguments. Now, if we go back to the other question, there was one of...
Shall I just say something about the referendum?
Yes,
you half invited me
yes,
to.
Indeed.
I'm generally against referenda. I don't think they're good ways of deciding things. I think Parliament should decide, really, to strengthen Parliament in a variety of different ways in the relationship between Parliament and the electorate. In this case, however, I actually first argued for a referendum in about 2008 because I felt that there was an enormous issue about the UK's position in the EU, which, because there'd been a referendum in 1975, could only be resolved by a referendum now. And I do take that view. I hope that David Campbell Bannerman and people like him, if the people decide to stay in the EU, as I hope they will accept the result of the referendum as definitive, and so that this issue is then properly addressed. But I generally think that referenda are bad ways of taking decisions of this kind. Now, you had three others, Mervyn, on bankers.
Okay, let me start with that, Neil.
Yep.
I'm not going to talk about or try and generalise from one individual case. And I think it's clear there were a number of episodes and instances of really bad behaviour in the banking sector. On the other hand, there are hundreds of thousands of people who work in banks, and my sympathy went out to... most people who work in banks earn actually rather modest salaries. There are people who work in branches across the country. They would never get the opportunity to earn that sort of scale of bonus, and it's very unfortunate for them that the profession they have chosen has become tainted by the behaviour of a few. I think the culture probably is changing in the sense that I think banks now realise not just that the culture was wrong, but that the obsession is perhaps too strong a word, but the enthusiasm for trading activities and investment banks is not the way to run in the long run now a successful bank. And it's quite interesting that the market itself has pushed down the size of investment banks. I mean, Goldman Sachs is quite a bit smaller than it was before the crisis. So that a number of big banks have abandoned investment banking altogether. Most dramatic are the Swiss banks, two big Swiss banks, which have abandoned investment banking and gone back to their traditional roles, wealth management functions. So I think there has been a change. I think more interesting in a way is the point you started with, which is the question of the anger of people who aren't bankers. And I remember having various dinners in the Bank of England in the early days of the crisis and saying exactly what you quoted me as saying, which is, I'm surprised people aren't more angry. But I think the consequence of that, and what I said at the time, was that the main reason for that seemed to be that the actions taken by central banks and governments at the time, not just individually but collectively across the industrialised world, which came to its head in the 2009 G20 meeting in London, was to take actions in the short run that would stop unemployment rising to the sort of levels we saw in the Great Depression. And unemployment did rise, but nowhere near as rapidly as it had done in the 1930s. And I think that meant that there wasn't the sort of overt anger. However, what you now see is that because people have failed to grasp the new ideas that I think are necessary and are described in the book, central banks and governments around the world have been following the conventional answer to this sort of downturn, and it's inadequate. So they're not succeeding. So what you're seeing around the industrialized world are people who can see that the center parties, irrespective of whether it's center left or center right, have failed to achieve an adequate recovery. And people are turning to extremes, not because they're particularly positively attracted to them, and it doesn't seem to matter whether it's left or right. You see both examples in Europe and elsewhere. But it's because they're not the centre. They're not the elite. And I do think there is a big problem now in which the apparent intellectual complacency of the elite is being exposed. And if you think back to the 1930s, what we remember from that is that that was a period of tremendous intellectual and political ferment right across the Western world. Whether it was communism, whether it was in some cases fascism, but people were looking for alternatives to the sort of simple market economy. Was that going to be good enough? And that was a period of great intellectual excitement, and people explored new ideas. Now, there hasn't been a parallel reflecting that. And what's happening, therefore, is that actually ordinary voters are now saying, well, you failed. You failed to deliver. And so, since you seem to be unconcerned about it, I mean, the statements of governments and central banks around the world just give the impression, look, you know, give us a bit more time and we'll be fine. I think that's wrong. And so people are understandably voting for alternatives, even if they don't have a clear positive vision of what they would like that alternative to be.
It's the theme of a book I did a couple of years ago called The Too Difficult Box, the failure of the central parties to solve the problems that people are exercised about, unsurprisingly, leads people to look for alternatives in different ways. Now, Citi, Treasury, Bank of England, which would you choose to implement your vision?
I would always go to the Bank of England, but with parliamentary support. the one thing I was very clear on in the crisis was that, you know, the Bank of England had been given specific powers by Parliament, and as a result, it could make independent decisions. But the independence of the Bank of England rested on parliamentary decisions to grant that independence. And I think one of the mistakes the Federal Reserve made in the crisis was to go too far in implementing its actions without explicit support from Congress. Mm-hmm. And you know, I was under pressure to do various things, buy various kinds of assets, to help. In one instance, one of your cabinet colleagues asked me to buy some paper issued by motor car companies. And I said, but this is not the responsibility of the Bank of England. Any company can take part in the scheme that we've put in place, which is a generic scheme. But if you're asking me to make judgments which would favour one industry over another, that is something for Parliament to decide and you as the Minister to decide. So I suggest you go and talk to Alistair Darling and see what he has to say about it. Well, I never heard anything again. but that, it is very important for us, and it's extremely important in the context of the euro area, where because there isn't a government of the euro area, you can't go to a particular minister. The European Central Bank is in a very difficult position of almost being forced to do things which turn it into a quasi-fiscal actor. And I think that's extremely dangerous for the support of the European Central Bank in the long run, because eventually people will turn around and say, well, you know, what authority did you have to do that?
Mm. Key point. I mean, I mentioned a very interesting chapter in Mervyn's book about the relationship between currency and nations. And in that book, he raises a lot of very serious questions about the sustainability of the euro and the various issues that arise, precisely because of the answer, I think, that you've just given. The final question this round was from Leslie about economists' predictions and what can be done about this situation.
So there are certain events which will never be able to be predicted, and I think this was probably one of them. A lot of people could see why certain things were unsustainable, and therefore it was not likely to continue indefinitely, but no one could easily foresee exactly how it would end. But I think what is more germane is this question, will there be another crash? And I think the answer is yes, unless some serious measures are put in place, both in the area of macroeconomic policy, but also in the area of reform of banking, to prevent it happening again. After all, if we look back over history, it would be arrogant to say that we will suddenly no longer experience the sort of banking crises that have littered our history. And I think that the way in which this is likely to happen is that around the world now you can see occasional episodes, incidents of the failure to repay debts. So in China, some debts have not been repaid to the financial institutions that lent the money to finance all the infrastructure that China started to build after 2008 as its response to the crisis. Within the euro area, Greece is clearly defaulting on its sovereign debt, even though it's not described as that. It's merely extending the number of years that it will be asked to repay, and there'll be no increase in interest rates. Rather as if you were told that your mortgage could be repaid over 200 years and at no higher an interest rate, and you could hand it on to...
It's all right, we're all living longer, so that should be all right.
You know, you can reduce the effective burden of the debt without an explicit default. But these quasi-defaults will occur. And, of course, when that starts to happen, people who's were on the opposite side of the transaction, on the asset side of their balance sheet, will suddenly realise that maybe those assets, money owed to them by other people, they're not going to get as much back as they thought, and they ought to be writing down the values of those assets. And that will expose them then to potential embarrassment because they may not have enough assets to repay their debts. And so this could become a bit of a chain. And I think that's the most likely way in which we will see the another crisis over the next, if it happens in the next decade. But at some point we will have one unless we put in place both different macroeconomic responses to the current challenge in the world and also to change the way in which we deal with banks towards the pawnbroker for all seasons that I described.
Thank you very much, Mervyn. We've just about come to the end of our time, and it's an appropriately profound note on which to end our discussion about economics, but I'm just going to conclude by one question on a dimension of your life which I think is not so widely known but deserves to be: your interest in sport. You were a director of Aston Villa, and I know as a Norwich City season ticket holder, which I am, I certainly shouldn't be joking about relegation in any circumstances, but I see you've now been sold to somebody else who says you're going to be in the top three clubs in the world very shortly, and you're going to rename Villa Park as Lotus Villa Park, which no doubt will lift your spirits quite substantially. But you're also president of Worcestershire Cricket Club, and I remember meeting you when you were governor, and you were giving, even at that time, support to the activity of cricket to try and strengthen cricket. You were setting about raising, I think it was £50 million, a lot of money anyway, to support the training of cricketers because of the worry that cricket was going downhill. And you just mentioned to me beforehand that actually the Department of Culture, Media and Sport sees this as one of the most successful schemes which has operated to encourage young people from a wide variety of different backgrounds into cricket, which I know is a love of yours. Can you just talk a bit about sport? I know it's completely different from what we're generally talking about, and it's not a big feature of the book, about your love of sport, but not just your love of sport, but your active engagement in trying to improve sport in this country.
Well, there are a number of sporting analogies and stories in the book used to illustrate points about economics. But maybe I can just say a word about why Mark Nicholas, who is now Channel 5, but is a major commentator in Australia and really transformed the television coverage of cricket here in the 2005 Ashes series. Mark Nicholas and I started way back in 2003 the programme called Chance to Shine, which is a programme to regenerate cricket in state schools, because it was becoming absurd how many of the... only 7% of children go to private schools, and yet a large chunk of the English cricket team came from private schools. And we wanted to regenerate cricket in state schools. Now, we did this not because we were trying to change the English side or to produce England cricketers, but because we believe that cricket should be, and other sports too, should be a key part of anyone's education. And it is very striking how in the best private schools that the idea that children just sit at a desk and study the national curriculum, no one would dream of that as describing it as an education. An education is giving children the chance to do all kinds of other things, whether it's debating, music, drama, or in our case, sport. And what we saw was that the great benefit of sport and bringing children to sport was that they would learn, A, to work in teams, but B, and most importantly, how to win and how to lose. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. How to be incredibly competitive on the field and yet be good friends with your opponents off the field. All of these things, I think, are a wonderful preparation for working life. And yet we have got ourselves into a very difficult position in which many state schools didn't want to have any aspect of competition in their schools, whether it means sport or music. The idea that someone was better than someone else at something was not encouraged. And we started Chance to Shine. We started with a programme. We didn't manage to get a lot of immediate encouragement from the cricket establishment because they didn't think it could work. We knew that to make this work, we had to manage it ourselves. So we went out and we hired a remarkable young man called Wasim Khan, who wrote his autobiography at a young age. He played county cricket. and it won the Wisden Cricket Book of the Year because it was a story of failure. He got into the Warwickshire side, which was then the best side in the country, moved to Sussex, and somehow his career just kept falling and falling and falling. And he gave up being a professional cricketer and walked through Birmingham, where he'd been brought up. His family, obviously Pakistani origin. And he went past his own school, and he remembered his own teacher giving him the chance to start. And so he started his own project in Birmingham, and then we hired him to run Chance to Shine. And now almost 4 million children have gone through British state schools and learning competitive, they play competitive matches. And, you know, now the cricket establishment loves this programme because it's the reason why the government gives money to the ECB. But it wasn't there to begin with. But it's what children get in an educational experience, so that, you know, we're not really interested in the elite form of the game. We can leave that to the MCC. But the benefits that children acquire from doing this, we've had lots of stories of children who were, you know, effectively dropped out of school, behavioural problems, weren't working. When they suddenly discovered that they actually could do something useful in playing cricket, their sense of self-esteem went up. They then became leaders of the school. They then would teach the younger kids it was important to do academic work, which they themselves had ignored earlier. All of this, it's just vitally important in all these different dimensions of a school to give kids the chance to find something at which they can shine. That, hence the name Chance to Shine.
Thank you, Mervyn. Well, on that note, I would like to thank you very much indeed, Mervyn, for coming today, to urge you all to buy the book. I'm not quite sure what the arrangements are, whether there's signings and so on that you can have. But anyway, I bought mine on a Kindle, unfortunately, so it doesn't have the great show. But,
you can buy a hard copy today.
joke aside, I really hope you buy the book. I hope you've enjoyed it. And thank you all for coming. We had a great set of questions. Thank you very much indeed. And thank you to the organisers, the Writers' Centre and the Norfolk and Norwich Festival for organising. I think it's been a really great discussion. Thank you all very much indeed. And thank you.